This is Audible.
Recorded Books and One Click Digital present A Serpent's Tooth by Craig Johnson, narrated by George Guidel, and directed by Abigail McHugh. One Click Digital provides free audiobook downloads in partnership with thousands of public libraries. To see if One Click Digital's extensive catalog is available to you, visit your library's website. And now, A Serpent's Tooth.
Chapter 1. I stared at the black and orange corsage on Barbara Thomas's lapel so that I wouldn't have to look at anything else. I don't like funerals, and a while ago I just stopped going to them. I think the ceremony is a form of denial. And when my wife died and my daughter Katie informed me that she was unaware of any instance where going to somebody's funeral ever brought them back, I just about gave it up. Mrs. Thomas had been the homecoming queen when Truman made sure that the buck stopped with him, which explained the somewhat garish ornament pinned on her prim and proper beige suit. Next week was the big game between the Durant Dogies and their arch-rival, the Warland Warriors, and the whole town was black and orange crazy. The only thing worse than going to the funeral of someone you knew is going to the funeral of a person you didn't. You get to stand there and be told about somebody you had never met, and all I ever feel is that I missed my chance. I had missed my chance with Dulcie Merriweather, who had been one of Durant's fine and upstanding women. After all, I'm the sheriff of Absaroka County, so the fine and upstanding often live and pass beyond my notice. On a fine October afternoon, I leaned against the railing leading to the First Methodist Church, not so much to praise Dulcie Merriweather, or to bury her, but rather to talk about angels. I reached out and straightened Barbara Thomas's corsage. One of the jobs of an elected official in Wyoming is to understand one's constituency and listen to people, help them with their problems, even if they're batshit crazy. I was listening to Barbara tell me about the angels who were currently assisting her with home repair, which I took as proof that she had passed the entrance exam to that particular belfry. I glanced at Mike Thomas, who had asked me to bushwhack his aunt on this early High Plains afternoon. He wanted me to talk to her and figured the only way he could arrange running into me was by having me stand outside the church and wait for the two of them as they departed for a late lunch after the service. I was trying not to look at the other person leaning on the railing with me, my undersheriff, Victoria Moretti, who, although she was trying to work off a hangover from too much revelry at the Basque Festival Bacchanal the night before, had decided to take advantage of my being in town on a Sunday. The only person left to look at was Barbara, 82 years old, platinum hair coiffed to perfection, and evidently mad as a hatter. So when did the angels pitch in and start working around your place, Mrs. Thomas?
Call me Barbara, Walter.
She nodded her head earnestly, as if she didn't want us to think she was crazy. As Vic would say, good luck with that.
About 2 weeks ago, I made a little list, and suddenly the railing on the front porch was fixed.
She leveled a malevolent glance at the well-dressed cowboy in the navy blazer and tie to my left, her youngest nephew.
It's difficult to get things done around home since Michael lives so far away.
As near as I could remember, Mike's sculpture studio was right at the edge of town, and I knew he lived only 2 miles east. But that was between the two of them. I adjusted the collar of my flannel shirt, enjoying the fact that I wasn't in uniform today, figuring it was going to be the extent of my daily pleasure. So the angels came and fixed the railing?
Yes.
Anything else?
She nodded again, enthusiastically. Lots of things. They unclogged my gutters, rehung the screen door on the back porch, and fixed the roof on the pump house.
Vic sighed.
Jesus, you want to send him over to my place?
I ignored my undersheriff, which was difficult to do. She was wearing a summer dress in an attempt to forestall the season, and a marvelous portion of her tanned legs was revealed above her boots and below the hem. Have you ever actually seen the angels, Mrs. Thomas?
Barbara, please.
She shook her head, indulging my lack of knowledge of all things celestial.
They don't work that way.
So how do they work?
She placed the palms of her hands together and leaned forward. I make my little list, and the things just get done. It's a sign of divine providence.
Vic mumbled under her breath, It's a sign of divine senility.
Barbara Thomas continued without breaking stride. I have a notebook where I number the things that have to be done in order of importance. Then I leave it on the room divider, and presto.
She leaned back and beamed at me.
He works in mysterious ways.
She paused for a moment to glance at the church looming over my shoulder and then altered the subject.
You used to go to services here, didn't you, Walter?
Yes, ma'am. I used to accompany my late wife.
But you haven't been since she passed away?
I took a deep breath to relieve the tightness in my chest, the way I always did when anybody brought up the subject of Martha. No, ma'am, we had an agreement that she'd take care of the next world if I took care of this one. I glanced at Mike as he smoothed his mustache and tried not to smile. And there seems to be enough to hold my attention here lately. I turned my eyes back to her. So you haven't ever seen them?
Seen who?
The Holy Handyman, for Christ's sake.
Barbara looked annoyed. Young lady, you need to watch your language.
I drew Barbara's attention away from a sure-shot, head-on, verbal train wreck. So you haven't actually seen the angels, then?
No.
She thought about it and stared at the cracks in the sidewalk, the strands of struggling grass having abandoned the hope of pushing through.
They do take some food out of the icebox every now and again.
I kept my eyes on her. Food?
Yes.
She thought some more.
And they sometimes take a shower.
A shower? She was nodding again.
But they always clean up after themselves. I just notice because the towels are damp or there are a few pieces of fried chicken missing.
I shot Mike a look, but he was studying the banks of Clear Creek on the other side of the gravel walk, a little ways away, probably checking for trout and wishing he was somewhere else. My eyes tracked back to the elderly woman. Fried chicken.
Yes. It would appear that angels really like Chester's fried chicken.
I leaned back on the railing and watched the dancing pattern of light on the water for a while myself, the scattered golden leaves of the aspens spinning like a lost flotilla. I see.
And Oreos. The angels like double-stuffed Oreos, too.
Anything else?
Werner's Diet Ginger Ale.
You must be running up quite a grocery bill feeding the legions. I smiled and chose my next words carefully. Barbara, when these things happen, I mean, do you make your list and then go to bed and get up and everything is repaired?
Oh, no. I do my agenda in the morning, then I go out to run my errands or go to my bridge club. And when I get back, everything's done.
In the morning?
By the middle of the afternoon, yes.
I pulled out my pocket watch and looked at it, noticing it was 10 after 1. So if I were to head over to your place right now, it's likely that I might catch the angels at their labors?
She looked a little worried. I suppose.
What is it you've got them doing today?
She thought. There's a leak in the trap under the kitchen sink.
Vic couldn't hold her peace. Wait, angels work on Sundays? I looked at the nice but crazy old lady. Where do they get parts on a Sunday? Buell Hardware is closed.
Her eyes narrowed. I get them the supplies, Walter. The Lord provides, but I don't think that extends to plumbing parts.
Hmm. I stood up and she looked concerned.
Where are you going?
I think I'll drive by your place while you and Mike have lunch. I shrugged. Maybe see if we can get Vic here a little divine guidance. Barbara Thomas folded her hands like broken-winged birds and spoke in a quiet voice.
I'd rather you didn't, Walter.
I waited a moment and then asked, And why is that? She paused, just a little petulant, and then looked up at me with damp eyes.
They do good works, and you shouldn't interrupt good works. Do you think there are more crazy people in our county than anywhere else?
We drove west of town in the direction of Barbara Thomas's house. and I turned down the air in the bullet so that the fan wouldn't blow Vic's dress any higher on her smooth thighs as she propped her cowboy boots on the escarpment of the dash. Per capita?
In general.
I redirected a vent in the direction of Dog, panting in the back seat. Well, nature hates a vacuum, and strange things are drawn into empty places. Sometimes oddities survive where nothing else can. I glanced over at her. Why?
That would include us?
Technically. She glanced out the windshield, her face a little troubled.
I don't want to end up alone in a house making lists for my imaginary friends.
I took a left onto Klondike Drive and thought about how Vic had seemed to be given to philosophical musings as of late. Somehow I don't see that happening. She glanced at me. I noticed you didn't offer to share your experiences with the spirit world with her. Vic was referring to the events in the Cloud Peak wilderness area that I'd had in the spring, an experience I wasn't sure I'd even fully processed yet. It didn't seem pertinent. Uh-huh. I gave her a look back and noticed she was massaging one temple with her fingers. How's your head?
Like hell, thanks for asking.
You mind if I inquire as to what happened at the Basque Festival? She adjusted her boots on the dash and confessed.
I was traumatized.
By what?
The running of the sheep.
I thought I must have misheard. The what?
The running of the fucking sheep which you conveniently missed by taking the day off yesterday.
The running of the sheep?
She massaged the bridge of her nose. You heard me.
What happened?
I don't want to talk about it. You don't want to talk about your imaginary friends, and I don't want to talk about the running of the sheep.
She played with the pull strap on her boot.
Suffice to say that I am not working the Basque Festival ever again.
I shrugged as we passed the YMCA and continued down the hill and past Duffy, the vintage locomotive in the park at the Children's Center. I took a ride on Upper Clear Creek Road, then pulled up and parked under the shade of a yellowing cottonwood next to the Thomas's mailbox.
We're walking?
There's shade here, and Dog is hot. I lowered the windows to give him a little extra air. Besides, I like to sneak up on my angels. How about you? She cracked open the passenger side door and slipped out, pulling her skirt down. Boots and short skirts, a look for which I held a great weakness.
I'm not exactly dressed for a foot race.
I closed the door quietly and moved around to the front of the truck to meet her. I thought angels flew.
Yeah, and shit floats.
We walked down the steep gravel driveway that ended in one of those old-time Model T garages and the tiny clapboard house that had been the headquarters for the T-Bar-T Ranch in years past, before housing developments had chiseled the land away. There was an abundance of raised flower beds and hanging baskets, and I had to admit that whoever the angels were, they were doing a heck of a job, especially this late in the season. Her tarnished gold eyes flashed.
By the book?
I looked at her lupine smile and thought about how you could take the patrolman out of South Philadelphia, but you couldn't take the South Philly out of the patrolman. Look, it's probably some kind-hearted neighbor doing the old girl a favor, so let's not scare them to death, okay?
Whatever.
She started to the porch, and I watched the faded purple dress flounce from her hips as she stalked off, unarmed.
Calling front.
I sighed and started around the back, slipping between the tiny garage and the house. I looked in the kitchen window and paused when I saw a set of legs sticking out from under the open cabinet doors of the sink. Covering the legs were a pair of olive-green work pants, the kind custodians wear, and the feet were encased in a pair of heavy brogans without socks. I shook my head and continued on, wondering which good Samaritan from the neighborhood this might be. I climbed the concrete stoop that led into the kitchen, pushed the button on the newly rehung screen door, and announced myself. All right, mysterious home repair, who's... My voice plugged in my throat when an extremely thin young man catapulted from underneath the sink and braced himself against the side-by-side refrigerator. I had a few seconds to study him. He was an odd bird, looked like a scarecrow, with the oversized pants tied at the waist with a piece of hemp rope and a tan work shirt that also looked to be about two sizes too large. His eyes were the bluest blue I'd ever seen, almost cobalt, wide and deep-set. He had a noble prince look about him, but maybe it was the blonde Prince Valiant haircut. I raised a hand in assurance and unplugged my voice. Howdy! The assurance was short-lived, and he leaped from the room straight into Vic, who was standing in the doorway leading to the living room and front door. He rammed his way past her, but to give her credit, even with a bloodied nose, she clung to his pant leg as he dragged her along with him. Motherfucker! I made the four strides between us just as the pants slipped from his narrow hips. He darted into the living room, bounced off the room divider, and hurtled through the doorway. I watched helplessly as he skimmed off the porch and was gone like a sidewinder. I didn't even bother pretending to chase him, went back into the kitchen, pulled a dishcloth from the stem of the spigot, and dampened it. I got some ice from the freezer and held it out to my undersheriff as she stood and looked at me. If I'd had my gun, I would have shot the little fucker. Did he hit you? His knee did when he bowled me over. Tipping her head back, I leaned her against the kitchen counter. I don't think I've ever seen anybody that scared before in my life. She held the cloth to her nose, muffling her voice. Wait till I get a hold of him again. I stretched the cord of the rotary phone over to where she stood, called 911, and pulled the cloth away to examine the damage. It was swelling, but it didn't look as if anything was broken. You're going to have a couple of beauties there. The phone at my ear suddenly came alive.
Absaroka County Sheriff's Office, you have an emergency?
Yep, Vic is going to kill a 15-year-old kid.
Sheriff?
I listened as Ruby's phone cradle jostled on his shoulder. Double Tough, is that you? I never was sure who was scheduled to rotate up from Powder Junction for weekend duty, since Santiago Cesar Vitoria, one of my other deputies, had run off to visit family in Rawlins for a couple of weeks.
Yep, what's up?
I've got a fugitive on the loose over here on Upper Clear Creek Road, and sure would appreciate it if you caught him before Vic does. I listened as he scrambled his way around my dispatcher's desk.
What kind of fugitive, Walt?
Male Caucasian, approximately 15 years of age, blonde hair, blue eyes with an expression like he's cleared for takeoff, and he was. I listened as Double Tough started to sign off.
Got it. One more thing.
Yep, Chief.
I picked up the pair of pants from the edge of the counter where I'd put them. He's naked from the waist down. For the first time in the conversation, my deputy was given pause.
Well, that should make things a little easier.
It didn't. We rummaged the entire neighborhood once and then again, but came up with nothing. We were in the office where Vic sat with a sack of frozen petite peas on her nose and watched me close last year's Durant High School yearbook. He's not in here.
She looked at me from over the bag of vegetables. You sure?
Positive.
You got the eight right?
I think so. I reached down and ruffled Dog's ears. He liked the relative cool of my abandoned office and the quiet of a Sunday afternoon. I guess you didn't get a very good look at him. She stretched her jaw in an attempt to loosen her facial muscles and stared at the escapee's pants on her lap.
You mean, did I get the number of the skinny truck that hit me? No.
Then he's from out of town. She studied the inside band of the pants.
Maybe.
She rested the frozen pouch on the dried bloodstains that were discoloring the neck of her dress.
What?
Are you sure you don't want to get your nose x-rayed? She dismissed me with a flapping of her hand.
What about the kid?
He just seemed odd. The next statement fairly flooded with sarcasm.
Really?
I conjured up the brief image of the scared young man and held it there in front of my eyes. The way he stood there for that moment, flexing his hands repeatedly, no eye contact, on the balls of his feet. He's a tard? I sighed and felt the bridge of my own nose. Just odd.
Health services?
I dialed the number and listened as it transferred me to the answering machine, which asked me to record a message. I declined and placed the receiver on the cradle. Who's the therapist over there?
Nancy Griffith.
I pulled the phone book from the top drawer of my desk and leafed through the G's. This stuff is a lot easier when Ruby's around. I pinned Nancy with a forefinger and dialed. On the third ring, she answered, and I described a young man she'd never seen. You're sure?
Positive. The description doesn't match up with any of our current clients. Have you tried the Wyoming Boys' School?
In Warland?
Stranger things have happened.
I listened as she chuckled and was reminded that she had sung in the church choir with Martha.
Hey, are you going to the football game on Friday?
Why, is there a problem? She waited a moment before responding.
Does there always have to be a problem when you're invited somewhere?
Generally.
It's homecoming, and they're retiring your number.
Oh.
They're retiring Henry Standing Bear's number, too. Didn't anyone get a hold of you?
There was another pause, but it wasn't long enough for me to come up with an answer or an excuse.
I think everybody up at the high school would appreciate it if the two of you showed up at halftime for the celebration.
Friday. I'll see what I can do. Thanks, Nance. I hung up the phone and watched as Vic reapplied the now-not-so-frozen peas to her nose.
What was all that about?
What?
Friday.
Nothing. I continued to think about the odd young man as I looked at the Durant Doggie's annual on my desk. He's got to live in the neighborhood.
Was she just asking you out on a date?
What? I glanced back up at her.
No.
Her tone became a little sharper.
Then what's Friday?
A football thing. They're going to retire my number.
She looked amused. You're kidding.
Nope. Henry's too.
I want to go.
No.
Come on. I never got to do that crap when I was a teenager.
She thought about it.
I never dated any football guys in high school.
I was momentarily distracted. What kind of guys did you date?
37-year-olds named Rudy with mustaches and Vans. Guys that would give my parents heart attacks.
She studied me.
I want to go, and I want a corsage, just like Babs.
She studied me when I didn't respond and slumped in my guest chair.
Please tell me we're not going to canvass the neighborhood in the short bus with Have You Seen This Half-Naked Retard posters.
I thought we'd knock on a few doors.
That or we just bait a few have-a-heart traps with double-stuffed Oreos. She struggled to her feet. But I don't think we have to do that here.
She reached down and held up the inside band of the pants toward me. It read, City of Belle Fouche Department of Sanitation. I made a few more phone calls to the services in Butte County, South Dakota, that were open on a Sunday afternoon. But they didn't know anything about a runaway, so we met Double Tough at the gravel turnout above the T-Bar T. Nothing? The ex-oil rig jockey was built like a brick pillar. When I first met him, he'd been shot, something he'd neglected to mention until later in the conversation, hence his nickname. Nope, and I asked at every house within a quarter mile of the place. Nobody's seen him or heard of him?
Nope.
I glanced down the driveway toward the little white house with the red shutters. I'll go down and tell Barbara that I'm going to have a look. Why don't you two just hang around up here in the shade and watch Dog? As I walked off, I heard Double Tough ask about Vic's nose. Just because he was Double Tough didn't mean he was double smart. I made my way to the front porch and told Mrs. Thomas about my intentions.
You don't have to do that, Walter.
I'd feel better if I had a look around. If you don't know this young man or anything about him, it might be best if we at least spoke with him. She nodded, but there wasn't much enthusiasm in it. As she closed the door, I made my way across the front of the house to the small garage and entered from the side door, which was adjacent to the walkway alongside the house. There was a scary-looking 1969 Mustang convertible with badges on the side that read Cobra Jet. It was semi-hidden underneath a car cover and was a testament to Bill Thomas's last vehicular purchase before his death in 71. The thing probably had 1,000 miles on the odometer and was the lust of every driving-age male in the county. There was a workbench to my right with an assortment of baby food jars filled with screws and nails that probably dated back to Fort Fetterman. But there were a lot of hand tools which looked as though they'd been used recently, as well as spare lumber that had been placed in the rafters along with a hidden stack of vintage Playboy magazines. Other than that, the place looked undisturbed. I closed the door behind me and remembered something Barbara had said about a pump house. We live in the high desert. And considering that the yard was very green and the flower beds abundant with blooms, I figured the water had to come from somewhere. Following my boots down a path overgrown with wild morning glories toward the bank of Clear Creek, I veered in the direction of the bridge.
I could see the pitched roof of the outbuilding that had had its shingles repaired recently, and could even make out the restored patch. The grass was higher as I cut off from the walkway, and I waded through the stalks to the small pad at the front. There was a clasp screwed into the surface of the door, but the rusted master lock was loose, and I unhooked it from the loop and pulled the door open with the wooden handle. It had probably been a smokehouse at some point, which would explain the faint odor of charred wood. That, and the rusted points in the rafters that were stained from the places where some kind of meat hook had been attached. There was a small 2.5-horsepower irrigation pump feeding water from the creek to a system with pipes that rose up through the dirt floor and then returned in 2-inch diameters. I walked around the pump, placed my hand on the outgoing line, and felt the surge of cold water as it flowed through. As my eyes settled in the gloom, I could see that there was a steel fold-up bunk running along the wall on the other side, the kind people used to use for guests. There was an old military blanket on the twin mattress, tucked in so tight you could have bounced a roll of quarters off of it. When I got to the bed, I heard a different sound under my boots, and stepped back, revealing the vague outline of something square buried in the floor. I kneeled down and brushed away some of the dust. There was a small hook on one side, so I moved it and lifted the lid of what appeared to be an old milk jug container buried in the dry dirt. It was dark in the hole, and I wished I was wearing my duty belt with my trusty mag light attached, but instead I just stuck my hand in the submerged box. The first thing I found was a magazine, Gun Buyer's Annual, this year's date. It was an encyclopedic guide to all the weapons available on the private market. The illustrations on the glossy cover, starring a collection of rifles, shotguns, semi-automatics, and radical carbines, had been thumbed away at the center where someone had spent hours studying the thing. I opened the magazine. Practically every page was dog-eared. I set it aside and reached into the hole again, this time coming up with a copy of Playboy, January 1972. The magazine was as worn as the gun almanac, and I had to admit that Marilyn Cole, leaning against a bookcase with a novel in her hands and little else, was still looking good, considering her photo was over a quarter of a century old, and folded into three equal parts. I rested what hardly seemed to be even mild porn anymore on the stack with the gun porn and reached into the hole again, this time pulling out a moldy-looking tome, threadbare, black with gold lettering, The Book of Mormon. When I carefully opened the cover, I noticed that it was published in 1859, and the handwritten inscription on the title page read, "For my son Orin, man of God, son of thunder, your loving mother, Sarah." I tucked the antiquarian book under my arm and stuck my hand back in the container in the floor, but couldn't feel anything else. I looked around the place for something, anything, but there was nothing. I returned everything except the book back to the hole, closed the lid, and kicked a little dirt back over it. I stood, keeping the book with me, and walked around the pump to give the dirt-floored room one more going over. I stepped through the door, closed it, and hooked the clasp of the lock back through the loop, careful to leave it as I'd found it. When I got back to the Thomas's home, I rapped my knuckles on the screen door and waited until Barbara appeared on the other side of the tiny squares, her image pixelated into a thousand parts. I held up the book and asked, "Who's Orin?" She placed a hand against the door jamb for support and silently put her other hand to her mouth.
"I don't know where he's from."
I watched as Double Tuff took another cookie from the plate on the kitchen counter. Barbara, Vic, and I and the Book of Mormon sat at the kitchen table trying to sort things out. "Well, when was the first time you saw him?"
"Like I said, about 2 weeks ago."
"You also said he was an angel." She blinked and looked out the kitchen window leading toward Clear Creek and the pump house.
I might have been confused about that."
Vic had discarded the now thawed peas for a cold pack, and her voice was, thankfully, muffled through the dish towel.
"Amen, sister."
"Have you spoken with him?"
"No."
"Where did he get the cot and blanket?"
she thought as she continued to look out the window. There were things in the garage that I noticed were missing, but I didn't really connect the two. Her eyes came back to me. Do you really think he's been living in the pump house these last few weeks?
I'd say it's a safe assumption. How exactly have you been feeding him? She looked at Double Tough, still munching on a cookie.
I just leave the food on the counter.
My deputy, feeling a little self-conscious, threw out a review as he chewed. Oatmeal, they're really good. The older woman's eyes returned to mine.
Can't we just leave him alone?
I cleared my throat.
No, we can't. He's not a stray cat, Mrs. Thomas. We've got to find out who he is and where he belongs. There might be people out there looking for him. You understand?
I do.
I picked up the book and opened it to the title page.
A couple of assumptions I'm making are that he's Mormon and that his name is Orin.
Vic couldn't resist. Orin the Mormon?
I ignored her and continued. I'm going to place my deputy here in your house this evening, if you don't mind, in hopes that the boy will return.
She nodded, first looking at Vic and then settling on Double Tough.
That'll be fine.